Well, welcome back to the Back Porch Education Podcast. Every classroom has its own unique temperature or feel or climate. And we want to talk today about what determines how that classroom feels. Is the climate of the classroom something you just simply control with the thermostat? Given the fact that every class is a little different, is it determined by the students in that classroom? How much is determined by the teacher? That's the topic for today. And of course, to go along with that, we have a poem for the day. And so, Jason, what you got for us today?
Dude, this one, I feel like it's a stretch, but in some ways. In other ways, it's not. I think this is a good one. This is, you remember, Steve, not last time, but a while back, we did the beginning of Tennyson's super long poem, In Memoriam. It started with Strong Son of God, Immortal Love. This is one of the sections from this. So this is section 106. Okay. He really got after it. This is an absolutely fantastic poem in its own right. And it's all about bells. So from what I understand, this, customary at the time was, you know how like Americans will shoot off guns on New Year's Eve, right? To bring in the new year. In England at the time, it was customary to ring bells. And so at the new year, people would ring out bad things and ring in new things. Okay. So this poem is about that. All right. So I don't have a title for it, just section 106 of In Memoriam. Ring out wild bells to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light. The year is dying in the night. Ring out wild bells and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new. Ring, happy bells, across the snow. The year is going. Let him go. Ring out the false. Ring in the true. Ring out the grief that saps the mind. For those that here we see no more, ring out the feud of rich and poor. Ring in redress to all mankind. Ring out a slowly dying cause and ancient forms of party strife. Ring in the nobler modes of life with sweeter manners, purer laws. Ring out the want, the care, the sin, the faithless coldness of the times. Ring out my mournful rhymes, but ring the fuller minstrel in. Ring out false pride in place and blood, the civic slander and the spite. Ring in the love of truth and right. Ring in the common love of good. Ring out old shapes of foul disease. Ring out the narrowing lust of gold. Ring out the thousand wars of old. Ring in the thousand years of peace. Ring in the valiant man and free, the larger heart, the kindlier hand. Ring out the darkness of the land. Ring in the Christ that is to be.
Yeah, bells are a big part of poetry.
Yeah.
Ask not whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee.
That's right. And
I heard the bells on Christmas Day.
The tintinnabulation which so voluminously swells from the bells, 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 bells. Yeah. Yeah.
So while the bell is the metaphor here, or the muse, it's the new year that's the point. Right. We've got all this stuff he wants to see go away and some stuff he wants to see come in.
Yeah.
I think it fits in wonderfully well with the notion of a teacher maybe trying to push away, get out of the room some things that maybe have crept in the past and start of the school year rather than the start of a new year. But same thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and I think that's, I like this poem for this episode in part because it's kind of like the funny, oh, ha ha, we have bells, that set our time in our schedule because of the horrible Prussian system that we don't have to get into. This is supposed to be good. You know, like there's that sort of bell situation going on. It works on that level, but it also works on a deeper level of purging the bad and bringing in the new, right? I think it's Aquinas or Anselm, one of those guys who says, when we uproot a vice, we ought to plant a virtue.
Yeah, you can't leave a void.
That's right. That's right.
And I think sometimes we let the classrooms, we take what we're given rather than trying to create something ourselves. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the bells, right? It's just easy to the bell rang, let's get started. And I felt that way very early in my teaching experience that when the bell rings, you all need to get quiet and we're going to start class and then it's my time. And it didn't work. I was teaching middle schoolers and they just keep talking. Yeah. And I'd be like, no, you know, class, the bell rang. You're supposed to want steak now.
Right.
Yeah. And so I recognized that there is a way the bell is an indicator to me that it's now my time, but I begin class and I begin it by praying.
Good.
And my students are taken back by that at first. I do it in the old liturgical way, the Lord be with you. And they stand and say, and with thy spirit.
Nice.
And then I cite the Trinitarian God and even go so far as to be Romish and cross myself.
Wow.
And they're like, whoa. and then sometimes it's a written prayer, especially on important days. I try to limit the wandering of my mind by putting right in my lesson plan the written prayer that I wish to pray for them. And other times it is a wandering prayer. Sometimes it's about things that are going on in school, and sometimes it's about a particular need of a student or whatever. But they know that once I say the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, Amen, class has already begun. And it's interesting, this year I have a medieval literature catechism that I'm leading my students through in the sophomore year. So they stay standing and we rattle off for 7 or 8 minutes our catechism.
Whoa.
And then we sit down, and by that time we're 10 minutes into whatever it is God has in store for us. And many of them are, always happens with seminar, but in many of my classes, the surprise is the end bell, not the beginning bell. Mm-hmm. The beginning bell, they almost don't notice it. And I kind of like that. Sometimes I'm taking attendance or I'm still getting myself together from maybe I stepped out in between classes. And so sometimes I let them have, I'm glad that they don't notice the bell. I don't want that to be what sets the tone.
Yeah, good.
But when I greet them and say, the Lord be with you, now Elliot's got us going. Mm-hmm. And so I've set this routine and it is a routine, but it's also to me, atmosphere. God is here with us. This is serious.
Yeah.
It's playfully serious. And they will from time to time even comment on what I choose to pray about, because it isn't always just grace in this hour to, you know. sometimes I will bring in things that not to be flippant, but things they weren't expecting.
Sure. Well, real life, right?
Especially with the written prayers. Yeah, well, and especially with the written prayers, I might choose some aspect. We're to be thankful for all things. And so if I choose to be thankful for this or that or the other thing that they might not have equated with this class, it gets them thinking and moving in the direction I want them to be. Mm-hmm. So I've resisted for many years the notion that I just play off of what the school gives me. Setting the tone of a lesson is pretty key to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think,
what do you do
I
to start
that's
class?
Good. So mine's,
you
much
start
the
with
same.
A poem.
Yeah, that's right. I do. We always do.
I know you do.
You know, so, I typically for a long time, I've done the Dominus Vobis Cum. So start there, and just like you do. Right. And so they respond, Et cum spiritu tuo. And from there, it's a poem. So it's not always Frost, okay, but it often is.
No, Tennyson apparently has a little bit to say.
Oh, he does. He has more to say than we have time to hear. His poem, The Two Voices, is always a big deal because the seventh graders learn pretty quickly from other like the previous grades, right? Like Tennyson's Two Voices is when Mr. Dolworth cries. So yeah, that's a pretty fantastic one. But there's that sort of thing, right? We start with a poem, and sometimes it's, man, perfect segue. Sometimes it's not, and that doesn't bother us. We just move in. We see what the poem has for us, or what God has for us in the poem. And from there, we move on to our lesson. So in any event, I like what you said, Steve, about routine setting kind of the climate, because the reality is there is a routine, and your routine is going to set a lot of the tempo of the class. So my stance is that you ought to be explicit about setting that routine, because yeah, it's going to be set regardless. So if you're not very careful about setting it, it's going to be set for you. And if it's set for you, you've missed an opportunity to hammer in some very, soul forming things, for your students and yourself.
Well, and it's the difference between maybe what a Stephen Covey, a proactivity versus reactivity type of thing.
He's the seven habits for highly effective, whatever. Okay.
Yeah. And he emphasizes in human relationships that proactivity, thinking ahead, anticipation is much better than reaction. And I think especially in a classroom, I mean, you're expected, I would assume you're expected by the powers that be to have a certain classroom decorum. They don't want bedlam, although my seminar classes can, we'll have to talk sometime about the 9 rules of dialogue from good old Stringfellow Barr. But he uses the word chaos and bedlam a great deal in describing what he was trying to implement way back in the day in St. John's College when they were working out the seminar for themselves. He admits that if you're pursuing the truth, there is a little unruliness that's going to be involved. But even there, I don't want to get in the whack-a-mole reactionary kind of classroom setting where I'm trying to shut down what's been created apart from me. I would much rather be leading, I guess is the right way to say it, than running around behind going, stop that. No, not like that, like this. And it's not going to come from teenagers. The mode that they're going to default to is probably quite a bit less desirable than what we might be able to conjure up ourselves. They need us to lead them in that regard.
Well, if we're any better at it than them, then what are you doing? How did you get the job?
I think that moves right into maybe the next big point is is climate a part of education? Are we teaching them something in how we conduct class? Or is it just what we're teaching them, the content? And I think you and I have talked enough on this podcast for people to anticipate that we're both going to say, well, how it's taught is incredibly formative to the soul of the student. And as a result, the more I think about the actions of the classroom and not just the quote-unquote material to be covered, but the means by which it's covered, the kinds of assignments I'm comfortable doing, the pace, you know, how many books are we going to read this year is a climate issue.
Oh yeah.
Right. So one of my problems with, and I'm sorry, I don't want to step on too many toes, but I'm good at it.
Sure.
one of my problems with the whole AP world is the fire hose issue.
Yeah. Let's be fair. The great book suffers from the same thing at times, right?
Sure. Sure.
Lest someone think that we're just going after institutionalized education of a whatever that stripe. The great books has the same sort of deal at times.
Right. Well, and it's an argument that's centuries old. Yeah. Is it better to cover a broad scope of material, you know, a half inch deep?
Yep.
Or really just, we're going to do the Odyssey all year long. and we're going down 1,000 feet into the ocean. We're going to find where Neptune lives. And I caricature it both ways because at least for me, the middle is probably the most desirable. I want to make sure that in a literature course, for instance, I don't just play to my favorites, or in a history course, great example, you know, I'm not going to spend half of my teaching time on some aspect of U.S. history that I particularly love, like Civil War or the 1960s or something. I'm going to try and be careful to present them all they need to know. So how deep or how long that goes, I'm still in control of that.
Yeah.
So if I'm assigning 80 pages a night or 8 pages a night, I'm determining a great deal about how they quote unquote feel in my classroom.
Yeah. And to get back to your earlier question, you are absolutely teaching your students not just content, but something about how content ought to be consumed and interacted with, right?
Well, and something of Pieper creeps in here.
Ooh, okay.
If you haven't heard our episode on Leisure, the Basis of Culture, go back and listen to that. But is this a work culture or a contemplative climate in the classroom?
Mm-hmm.
Are we sweating? And I don't mean to push too far back against the word, but I sometimes get nervous when I hear rigorousness overemphasized in education, because in its history, it's a negative term.
That's right. Rigor mortis.
Right. Well, yeah, it's not always something you want. You know, it's usually used to describe something that's too hard.
Yep.
And yet, because I think it's a reaction to the concern in the 70s and 80s that all the curriculum was getting dumbed down and it's too easy, so we offer a rigorous program. We're pushing back, but it can be too easy. It can be too hard. It's the Goldilocks problem, right?
Finding, sure.
And I don't know that's another question, I guess, for the discussion. Is there a particular climate? You know, we usually use the term climate to refer to what the temperature is in the classroom.
Yeah.
And I had a wonderful time. My first teaching assignment was in a room that shared the thermostat was in my room, but it controlled next door, which was a kindergarten classroom. So I had 8 eighth graders and she had 30 little heat machines.
Yeah. So you were freezing all the time.
Well, she would come over, and it was at times it was comical.
Yeah,
because I would adjust it to make it at least bearable for my kids, and then she'd be right back over to adjust it with me, you know. And what is the right temperature?
Yeah,
is it 73? Is it 75? Is it 65? Is it 82? You know, you and your wife have those conversations, right?
Sure.
So I think that is just a little metaphor for almost everything in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Some teachers prefer a little bit of the edge to it.
Yep.
Some like it a little more rowdy. Others think that students flourish best in a highly, I don't want to use the term rigid, but a quiet,
mm-hmm.
oriented,
placid.
Ordered.
Yeah.
placid classroom. Yes. Where you can hear the pencils scribbling away on the paper or whatnot.
Yeah. So I think, I don't know what your preference is, but for me, I'm definitely, I tend toward the rambunctious, the raucous. I don't want it to be out of hand, but almost. that's where I'm pretty comfortable. And
why is that comfortable for you? What is it about that climate that makes you happiest?
Because man, truth is, it's just, you got to run after it to catch it. And it's unexpected, right? I like the feeling of not knowing where it's going to come from next, but always on the lookout for it and always ready to chase it down. And so I don't know. It's something that has been fun for me to experiment with and to sort of see, but as I've, now this happens a lot more as I have students over several years, but some of the most wonderful times have come about when we have been bouncing around ridiculously, frustratingly, I'm no doubt, for someone who has not been a part of the conversation for the past 3 or 4 years, right? If you walked in, you would say, this is a madhouse. But we're bouncing around, and then all of a sudden, truth breaks in and we settle down pretty softly, you know, pretty quickly, all of a sudden. And so I like that. That's a lot of fun for me. I don't have any trouble at all running around until something happens. And then all of a sudden, really kind of bearing down on that thing.
Right. And I think that there's a lot of climate is relationship.
Mm,
okay. One of the great books that I read on this years ago now, long time ago, Parker Palmer's The Courage to Teach, you know, the title reveals that he's trying to give some courage to teachers. They have a hard job. But a lot of the what I saw in it that affected me was his discussion of safety.
Okay.
That for him, above all else, a classroom has, if you're pursuing truth, there has to be a relationship of trust. The student has to know that the pursuit of truth includes mistakes and that it's okay to make them.
Good.
In fact, it's valued.
Yeah.
It's not belittled. It's not laughed at. It's not
harshly criticized or something like
right,
that.
Right. Slam to the ground. No, right. You're wrong. But it's so I'm in another school year. I have another set of seniors. Today was our very first attempt at a seminar. And it is difficult because they don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. And they don't trust each other.
Yeah.
And one of my students, who's also a former student of Jason.
Oh, boy.
Made a comment. And I said, nobody else said anything. And I said, well, I don't know if I can agree with you. And she looked at me like I had just slapped her across the face. And I said, sweetie, I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying I have a perspective I'd like to present that might either change your mind or mine.
Yeah.
And it's not mean to challenge each other. It's good and necessary and can be fun, but it demands what you were just describing. When they've been in it with you for several years, mm-hmm. they know what the rules are, so to speak. They know what's up.
Yeah.
And so they trust you and themselves to keep it safe. Whereas total strangers do a lot of, and I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but to me, sometimes that's what determines culture or the climate more than anything else, is the teacher and students don't know each other.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think we ought to be upfront about that, right? Like, hey, so I'm sure there's somebody listening like, okay, cool, dude, but I have new, like 150 new students every year, right, and I get them 3 times a week for 50 minutes. Okay, well, guess what? We're going to have to be way more explicit about setting the tone of, we don't know each other, so here's what politeness looks like. Here's what arguing looks like. Here's how far we can take it. Let's not hurt one another beyond repair here. You know, like that's, you gotta do that work if you want the good stuff of conversation.
Well, and you're, if people are doing the math in their heads, you just described college.
Yeah, right.
3 times a week for 50 minutes. Yeah. And college offered me a unique opportunity that I'd never had. Well, I guess in a small private high school that I was involved with as a student, I had some of this. But college, going to a very small college, 4,000 kids, afforded me an access to professors that I just never felt as capable of in high school. Mm. My contact with teachers was pretty much limited to the classroom. And in college, some of our favorite professors became that way from interactions outside the classroom.
Yeah, me too. Small liberal arts school for the win, I think, on that one.
Yeah, and you'd see them in the snack shop or something. I've been meaning to ask you, and you'd ask that zinger, and they'd smile and say, well, you know, let me get you a cup of coffee and let's talk about that. And, yeah, and then, then that changed the dynamic, at least for me, in the classroom as well. Because I knew that it wouldn't be possible for that professor to answer that personal question in a context of 150 students. But if what was happening in the classroom brought up questions, I knew I had access to him outside. So, and I think that's possible. That's, of course, the most of what we're describing at the moment. If the listener is involved in homeschooling, they're going, what the heck are you talking about?
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
Because that a lot of what we're talking about is overcoming things that are foisted upon us. The climate's entirely determined at the home, and yet I think still ought to be thought about.
Totally.
You shouldn't just, you know, I've known people who literally rang bells in their home to move from subject to subject. I was like, what are you doing? Stop that.
I don't
have to do that. You're the only people in the world set free from that stupid thing. Don't feel like you've got to make your child feel like he's in school.
Yeah. You know what I'll say about that? I'll say this. Homeschool allows you a lot of freedom. So if you want to ring a bell, that's your prerogative. Everything's your prerogative, you know? So good for homeschool that you can make that choice. I might say you leave the bell somewhere else, but that's your thing. So, okay, cool. Okay, let's cover one more thing. What do you think about the physical space, Steve, of a classroom?
Well, let's run right back to that thermostat I talked about earlier. The little lady running over and adjusting the thermostat was radically different. My classroom itself is at times painfully bare. Barren. Huh. Yeah. Plain.
Vast.
Vast stretches of untouched wall.
Yeah.
And I don't have a lot of personal mementos, and I don't. And she's teaching kindergarten, and it was amazing. Mm-hmm. You had no idea what color of paint was on the wall. She literally would overlay. She would go to these conventions and stuff and buy all this instructional material that went on the wall. And she stated that there were bulletin boards in there, so I could not see evidence of such. It was just layered, laminated stuff all around the walls. And then when she ran out of wall space, she'd still get these cool things. And, oh, I got to put this in my room. So she discovered that you could string them. You know what a hanging ceiling is, a false ceiling.
Yeah, yeah.
She would run string through the little grid.
Oh, boy.
And have stuff hanging. And then at lunch, the usual conversation was,
I got more kids this year that have attention problems than I have ever had. And I'm like, lady, you keep putting all this stuff. If I was a kid in your class, I wouldn't know what to look at first. The students had a pretty good idea what to look at in my class. The only thing that was going on is this talking dude up in the room.
And so, four white walls.
Yeah. Well, and I have taken that into consideration. I do recognize nowadays, and if you walk in my room today, the first thing that everybody notices is my books.
Yeah.
I got one wall just totally filled with books, and that seems odd for people, and I don't know why, because it's a school. But I do put artwork up. I do put some thought into what kind of mementos I keep in my room. There are some things that connect me with past students, things mm-hmm. that students have made, some project. I have a great guy, Montag, Fahrenheit 451's main character, that a kid made out of junk around the house, but it looks awesome. And so it's been given a place of prominence in the back of my room.
That's
students
cool.
will go, who made that? No, Blaze made that. Oh, I remember Blaze. So lighting is a big deal to me. My school came through and put in LED lights, and they're harsh, man.
Yeah.
And so if my students are starting to kind of get a little middle of the afternoon, we could take a nap now. I'll sometimes walk over. They're fortunately dimmable, and they're usually dimmed down a decent amount with window shades open to let natural light in. But if they're getting a little sleepy, I just walk over there and zoom them babies up to full power, and you know, so I can control that.
High alert.
And music. This has been a discussion that's 30 years old with me now. I love music.
Okay. Yeah.
I respond well to music myself. But then it's this tug of war. They want their music playing, and I tell them that's just not. It's not that I don't do or don't like your music. That's irrelevant.
Right.
The climate of the classroom has to be such that you can study by it, that you can think, and I know what's going to happen. I put your music on, you're going to be thinking about it rather than the text, or you know, typical music is only playing when they're doing quiet work of their own rather than us trying to do something together. But
yeah, so music for me is the thing that I want to incorporate more, but I can't find a way to do it that adds to what's going on.
See, I would think that if you took a seat on a stool and as you recited your poem, played your accordion.
Okay. Weird Al style.
Wah, wah, wah. Yeah. It put a whole different light to some of your poetry. But
yeah. Okay. Last thing. I wish that I had a very busy room in terms of like my wall space, just so that we could have a good conversation about why we did it differently. But I'm very much like you in terms of my contention has always been that the more there is on the wall, the less time each student will spend looking at any individual thing. Mm-hmm. So I have always kept it very sparse and only put the most important thing or things on my wall. So, you know, just literally one or two paintings. And that was it, you know, and I like that. I don't know how other people did it, but that was good for me.
Well, I have, so some of my projects are, because we do literature, like when I don't currently teach Rime of the Ancient Mariner, but when I did, it evoked a lot of creativity from my students. And some of the better
you would come in with an albatross on your neck.
Yeah, well, but that was the low hanging fruit.
They would
draw pictures or make a paper mache albatross, or they would produce artwork. That poem made many of them became a muse for them.
That's cool.
Yeah, and so then I realized, and I didn't keep it up, but I realized that hey, I'm going to choose one or two of these and we'll display it the rest of the year you know, right outside my room or in my room or something like that. And so that was fun. And I could see myself getting back into that at some point. But the one idea I'll throw out there that I thought was clever and it completely flopped. Okay. Less people yeah, think that perfect. everything I ever tried worked. The big sticky notes. I mean, the ones that are like a foot and a half across by 2 foot tall.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like a big sketch pad, but it's got a sticky thing across the top of it. I got one of those 1 year. Some parent just gave me this. I don't know if you can use this in class or not, but here's this thing. They're fairly expensive, like $35 or something. And I had a few of those markers or whatnot. And so I found an easel and I put it in the corner of the room. And every time a student, and this is middle school, every time a student would give me one of those, wow, that was really good statements. I'd take the time, I'd go over and I'd put a quotation mark and I'd write out what they said in the quotation mark and put their name at the bottom and boom, slap that bad boy up somewhere on the wall.
I've got to say, that sounds like a totally awesome idea.
I thought the history of thought from this year, think about what May could be like. Yeah. Remember when Billy said, and then over here later, Susie said, it fell apart because there was a recurring name on many, there was a witty kid that got a lot of the write-ups. And then some, you know, more than once I had a kid just a little tear running down their cheek. You're not going to write up my comment? I thought it was really good. Oh, honey.
Right.
No, it didn't make the cut, you know.
Right.
And they're just it is, yeah. They're crushed. What? Oh well.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that. You saved me by telling the end of the story because that was something I was ready to implement.
I still write some of them down, you know, put them on a private blog somewhere so I can remember them, but
yeah.
I don't put them up on the wall anymore. So.